Hello and welcome to the first episode of Informer of 2024. Astute listeners might have noticed that we have some new music today at the opening. It's actually a piece I made in another lifetime about 17 years ago when I was, about 10 years old? Hardly. I used to be an electronic musician back in the day and stumbled across some old recordings and thought I would use it today. I know it's been a little while. I've been away for quite a few months now, I guess about 6 months. It's been a very busy and exciting time, and I look forward to sharing some of the work that I've been doing in the near future. In the meantime, I'm really happy to be back today with a guest who I spoke to in late fall of last year. You can hear that in the interview. But I think the work that they're doing is even more relevant in many ways now. And today I speak with Zachary Small. They're a staff reporter for the New York Times covering arts journalism. And what I love about their work is that it is, it's about the arts, but it's really about the structures within which the arts and artists themselves work in terms of power relationships, politics, money, all the things that often do not get talked about in the art world, and in particular, the relationship between technology and emerging technology and its intersection with that world. This will make a lot more sense once you hear them speak about their work. And I'm very happy to share, too, that the timing for this couldn't be better because their book, Token Supremacy, The Art of Finance, The Finance of Art, and The Great Crypto Crash of 2022 is going to be published this spring from Knopf, and I believe it's coming out in May. So it was a pleasure to be able to speak with them for Informer, and without further ado, here's my conversation with Zachary Small.
Hey, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Good to see you. How's it going?
I'm good. How's it going for you?
Good, good. It's just it's like a really lovely day. I'm up here in Massachusetts at the moment, and I've never spent much time in New England in the fall, and it is amazing. All the stereotypes are true. It really, you know, it's like it's really pretty.
Are you having a Christian girl autumn up there?
Yes. It's the real deal. But thank you so much for taking some time today. It's funny for me to be asking you the questions, so I'm still sort of getting used to that. But I understand that you know, we have a limited amount of time, so I would love to maybe just dive right in if you're okay with that. And
I have some experience with questions and answers.
I was going to say this is
able to.
Yeah, it's another day in the office for you probably, but thank you for joining me today, Zachary, and it's a pleasure to catch up and learn more about what you do. And also, I think one of the reasons I was really excited to speak to you today is because I'm so curious to hear more from you on your perspective of what you see sort of shifting in the art ecosystem. You have a perspective on national and international work that I think is so unique. And also, I just feel like you're bringing such an interesting perspective to a major platform around uncovering things that are often hidden in the arts. And so I guess to just begin, could you share a little bit about the work that you do, how you got there, where you're working at this time, and just any background, personal or otherwise, that would just help listeners understand how you got to where you are?
Yeah, so currently I am on staff at the New York Times as a reporter covering art and technology, and also video games, which I kind of jokingly describe as every child's dream. And it, you know, it is kind of an amazing job where I'm across so many different disciplines, but really looking at the questions of like, what is driving culture? how our power and privilege impacting, what we get to see and what's produced and what gets that sort of main stage appearance. In many ways, I think that, this is a job that I've been preparing for my whole career, although I didn't really know it. So I grew up in sort of a small town in Connecticut, very sort of rural with farms around me. And my interest in art really didn't develop until much later. I don't come from an art family. There weren't that many museums around us, although, New York City was maybe like a 2, 2.5 hour train ride away. So my access into art was in theater. And, cut the story and fast forward. After college, I was doing professional theater in the city, and I would go to these huge cattle calls. And this was back in the day, not that long ago, when you would have to sit there in these cattle calls. Like, you get there at 4 a.m. and you wait, it's essentially the whole day to get seen for like 30 seconds. And so I was bored. And I said, what can I do during this time? I was like, you could write an art review of an exhibition for like $50 for Hyperallergic at that time. And that was something to do. So that's how I started out, was really in criticism. And I majored in art history as well in college, but more so because I saw it as a way to study philosophy and politics. And I studied politics as well. So it's always been a very weird combination of interests for me. But it certainly worked out. Now we're in a moment where it feels like what's happening in the art world is inextricable from politics and the economy.
I love to ask all of my guests what their first memory of art was. And for some people, it's very easy to answer, and for others, it opens up a whole series of recollections. What would you say is your earliest memory of art?
It's a great question, and one I think about a lot because, as I said, like I didn't grow up really in an art family, and probably the first time I went to the Met was when I was in AP art history and like 17, 18 years old, and we had a field trip. So it was, later in life, but I guess it depends on how you define art. If you're going to define video games as art, it would probably be a little bit earlier when, a cousin came over when I had chicken pox and played Super Mario World, and I was like, wow, what is this weird thing? I mean, in terms of like art, I mean, I did my sort of college thesis on John Baldessari, and I think experiencing Baldessari's work sort of, 19, 20 years old was really impactful for me. Again, I was always interested in philosophy, and John Baldessari is a conceptual artist from California who's a really funny guy and really smart. And he found ways to create work that, came out of sort of the Vietnam War era and this like sort of spoiled optimism of the time of what art could do. And I always found that really interesting that, he could make work that was questioning, our own perspectives, and he was an amazing artist.
Yeah, I hear you. And I'm so curious, this kind of intersection that you're pointing to between power, politics, and art. And then interestingly, the sort of third corner of the triangle of technology and a relationship to technology. And I'm curious, like how do you see those elements sort of interacting with each other? And was there how did you sort of begin to connect the dots between your interests in technology and art and bigger ideas around philosophy or politics? And is there a reason that technology is included in that focus?
I mean, like most things in my reporting career, it's all kind of based on a hunch. And then I go out and, I have to prove my hypothesis true. And the relationship between art, technology, politics, and the economy It sounds like a lot, but really it's all the same thing, right? Our technology right now, if you're looking at artificial intelligence or facial recognition software, that's being used both in a policing capacity, but also in the art world. And I think once you start digging in, as I have, and looking at where this technology comes from, as well as NFTs and crypto, all of these buzzwords that we're hearing in the news, artists are oftentimes the first line of alarm bells when it comes to this technology. The companies that produce this, whether it's Google or, some other sort of major conglomerate, they oftentimes invite artists to test that technology. And that might contribute to the companies developing these products, but it also shows just how intertwined. And this has been true forever. In the 1960s, there was a group called Experiments in Art and Technology that like Robert Rauschenberg was a part of. And there were a ton of engineers from Bell Labs in New Jersey who were, at the forefront of tech at that time. So it's, one of those funny things in art where, there might be some tech adverse people in the art world a little bit, right? Like we get into this because it like we don't have to do math sometimes. But in truth, in reality, like there is a really close relationship. And as I've sort of grown up and grown into my role as a reporter, there's an increasingly close relationship between tech, venture capital, and the art market.
I hear you. And I mean, that's one of the reasons I really find your reporting so interesting and really wanted to speak to you is because in my position and just in my career outside of iBeam and otherwise, that is something I've just seen over and over again is exactly what you're describing, where artists are canaries in a coal mine in a sense in terms of what's coming down the pike in relationship to technology. And it's so fascinating, and it's something that's really difficult to talk about sometimes. And I feel like your reporting often sort of pulls the curtain back on some of those relationships. What are some of the things that you have learned in your work that you sort of wish everyone was aware of? Like, are there stories that you just feel deserve more spotlight, or are there even, behind the scenes interactions that you feel are just deserving of more attention in both the art ecosystem as well as, the world?
That's a great question, and now I'm trying to like vamp for time as I think of how to best answer it. I think the art world, in many ways, is very much a walled garden. It's both, related to, it has the vines creeping out over the walls of the garden into the general public, but a lot of the ways that decisions are made are mysterious. The art market is also the essentially the largest unregulated market in the world, where you have hundreds of millions of dollars being transferred between, private entities or private collectors through auction sales and private sales as well. So, what I always try and impress upon people is like, we're just kind of skimming the surface. And my job is to go a little bit deeper, is to really fact check scrupulously anything that I'm putting out there and reporting. And that's one of the great things about working for the Times is that on the culture desk, we have editors who have been there for decades, and on different beats. Someone might have covered police back in the day or City Hall, and now they're working on, producing these reports on the art world with me. So I think in terms of your question with like the untold stories or what I want people to know about this process is like, I think there are a lot of assumptions about how the art press behaves and how these, stories come about. But, the bar, especially at the New York Times, is very high for stories in general. But I can't really often work on, an unattributed source or an anonymous tip, right? I really need to know who I'm talking to. And even then, our bar for like sort of anonymous sourcing is your life is threatened, which is not usually the case in the art world. So there's a lot of relationship building that goes into my reporting. And beyond that, I mean, getting audio recordings of things, videos, documents, I always tell people, especially with the large investigations that I do, what you're seeing on the page is probably like 30% of the reporting I've done, right, just because not everything is necessarily publishable for those variety of factors I've sort of listed out now.
Yeah, that's a great segue into one of the things I wanted to ask you about, which is, what is a typical day for someone on your beat? I mean, how are decisions made? You know, I'm not even aware of someone who had your beat previously. And do you feel like you're sort of developing, you know, that role while you're there? I feel like there's a whole collection of interesting, you know, pressures and factors and circumstances that, you know, would probably come into the kind of work that you're doing. And anything you can share to just help us understand, you know, what a day in the life looks like for you and the work that you do?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I would say every day is very different. If there's breaking news, you know, I'm going to hop on that immediately, have a conversation with my editor about what we want to do, and, you know, start reporting as soon as possible. You know, with an investigation, it's different. You know, those are sort of slow burns. They take months and months. Our recent investigation into the human remains collection at the American Museum of Natural History, for instance, took about 3 to 4 months to develop. And I was going into the cadaver archives at Columbia University,
wow,
going to the museum's research library over the course of a couple months within that. And, you know, that's the kind of thing where, again, I sort of had a hunch, you know, just knowing what I know in the art world and in that reporting of like, you know, if I really sit down and I really look through these primary documents, I'm probably going to find something. So it really depends. Like, those are the two extremes of the speeds, right? There's breaking news, you got to hop on it. I got to, you know, make a dozen calls as soon as possible. And then there's the investigation, which is a little bit like playing chess and trying to understand, you know, where are the hard facts here?
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to work on assumptions. Like, I need something written down.
Right.
And then in between that, you know, I think, as I've developed this role, which is very new and strange at the times, I've really enjoyed focusing on special projects and developing things like, you know, we had a feature on the Legend of Zelda series and
you
know, very critically acclaimed and has all of these artistic influences as well. But to develop that, it involved working with interactive designers at the New York Times. There was like a team of 6 or 8 people to create that system. So, and we have a couple of things cooking right now that, again, it like takes months of conversations and in development to do, but I think that the results are so wonderful. And we just had one on the artist David Solly and artificial intelligence,
right,
where, you know, the question with AI and art for so long has been like the fear of what AI will do to art and devalue it supposedly, that I just wanted to like kind of cut through a lot of the clamor and talk to an artist with a long career who is, if not embracing this technology, experimenting with it in a really determined and deliberate way. And so we were able to create this sort of scrolling adventure for readers where they could see how David Solly was using AI to develop better and better tools.
Yeah. I mean, that's brilliant. That's so cool. And I completely agree with you. I mean, that's exactly the kind of reporting that actually illuminates what AI is rather than adding to either fear or confusion. Maybe you could nudge your colleagues to not write any more stories on AI and your soul. That might be helpful.
I don't know.
As well.
I don't know. Maybe, but I don't you think that, you know, I mean, what's the end goal of AI, especially as it's developing all these capabilities of creating art or, you know, pattern recognition in sort of visual culture, like, mm-hmm, right. Especially for these technologists who make it, like, art is the pinnacle of the human soul. It's an expression.
I totally agree. I absolutely. I think, I think more what I was getting at is like one of my, I don't know, sort of whipping horses at the moment, you could say, I guess, is I just feel like we need more awareness around the mechanics of AI before we even
The
very
AI is
sort
not
of
going to steal your soul,
right.
which is what they said about cameras and photography when that was being popularized in, the 1800s. So no, I totally agree with you on that point. And I think as well, we've done a good amount of reporting, and I had a story over the summer about racial bias in artificial intelligence and how artists were sort of trying to combat that. And in my conversations with dozens of people developing these tools, they were telling me about how AI is supposed to be this black box of information that, you can't really get in and see how it's, making decisions. And I pushed back on that a little in these interviews and said, well, why is it that way? And the truth is, like, it doesn't have to be.
Agreed.
They could develop AI that sort of gives you a sense of where the traits are coming from. But it's not necessarily in their business interest to do that because it opens
Exactly.
them up potentially to legal liability.
Exactly. I was speaking to an artist yesterday who had exactly that problem. He's working on a huge project involving facial recognition using AI. He has to use a AI system that is woefully outdated from like 5 years ago because it's the only one that is even open enough for an artist to be involved in. And he's been actively reaching out to Google and other companies. And just as you stated, it's not in their business interest to even open the black box. So I feel like that mythology of the black box is the thing I think sounds like you and I are in agreement on that is really in need of some thinking about how it's reported and understood publicly, I think. I mean that just raises so many questions on so many levels. And the kind of reporting that you're doing is opening up the black box of the art world of these technologies. And I wonder, like, how do you see yourself positioned in kind of the larger arts ecosystem, if you will, given the kind of work that you do? Where do you see yourself sitting in terms of relationship to even gallerists or collectors or artists themselves or the market and so forth?
Yeah, and I think that compared maybe to some other arts journalists, I do occupy kind of a weird space, and that is very intentional on my part. I am kind of an insider outsider. I think I've reported enough on the art world to know a little bit about the mechanics, but at the same time, again, like, I don't come from an art family. I'm not ensconced maybe in this myth of cultural exceptionalism, where, oh, it's art, like, forget about all of the rules around buying and selling that we have in every market. I very much push to ask, well, why is it exceptional? And I think that's the question that goes into all elements of my reporting. If we're going to cover an artist, why are they exceptional? And if we're going to cover fraud and money laundering, it's the same question, really. Yeah, and I think, when I entered sort of arts journalism, and made the transition from criticism to reporting, my goal was always to question those things that editors would be like, oh, well, that's how it's always been. That how is that news that people are making backroom deals, right? How is it news that working at this museum or that museum is really a toxic workplace? And I think we've seen over the last 5 years that, I mean, those have been the major news stories. And the same with repatriation, that was kind of a non-issue for a good amount of time. And now it's like, there's a headline every day about something being burned.
It's so true. And you must see impacts of your reporting in the world. Could you talk a little bit about that?
You want me to brag about myself?
Feel free.
I would say again, like, there's a whole team of people behind me who work on these stories, and editors, and just conversations. And I think people would be like so surprised to hear the sort of like minute details that we go over. Like if someone tells me in an interview that their favorite color is blue, my editor might be like, did they really say blue? Like, or did they mean like periwinkle? Like, or you know, is it like a specific color of blue, like cerulean? Like maybe, you know, maybe I'll go back and have to fact check that. And so the sort of granule detail at the times, like we really do try and go through it as finely as possible. But in terms of the impact that some of my reporting has had, you know, I think a big moment was when we were reporting on allegations of sexual misconduct at the Philadelphia Museum of Art a handful of years ago. And it was a story where a manager was being accused by multiple women. The museum found out about it. And they had this sort of hush agreement where he was allowed to leave the museum. He became director of the Erie Museum of Art. And, you know, nobody was the wiser. And so we started digging into that and asking questions of like, well, how does that happen? You know, if something that harsh happened at the Philadelphia Museum, one of the most prestigious museums in the world, and you know that there was this sort of problem, you know, especially at the managerial level, how does a museum let that happen at another institution and not say anything? And that reporting, you know, we're still sort of seeing the effects of it in Philadelphia, where the museum, you know, the staff of the museum later unionized, the director stepped down. There were calls from politicians in Philadelphia for reforms at the museum. And lo and behold, the museum has made many of those reforms. And, you know, the employees are now organized and more publicly able to voice, you know, their opinions on leadership. And I think that's had a ripple effect. And then on another side of reporting with public monuments during the de Blasio administration in New York City, the focus of that administration on creating monuments to women, because there's like five now, I think six monuments in the city to historical women, and there's hundreds and hundreds to men. They made a lot of promises that they ultimately couldn't keep. And by the end of the de Blasio administration, essentially none of the statues to women that he had promised were built. So that became, you know, an important story between art and politics, where there was some grandstanding, maybe you could say, involved. And, you know, that was taxpayer money. That was millions of dollars in taxpayer money that just kind of went nowhere.
And I mean, that's so interesting. And it really just does point to the role of the arts in these larger power structures in a way that just feels so important. Do you see that the general arts journalism world is moving more in that direction, or do you feel that that you're still a bit of an outlier in that regard? I mean, obviously there are, you know, very focused publications that do a lot of this, but I guess I'm just thinking more in kind of the mainstream, as it were, kind of art world.
Yeah, and I think about this question constantly. My answer is that it's very herky jerky. There are a lot of arts journalists who are really interested in the same questions that I am, but there are sometimes limitations in the art press about what you can write about, whether that's because of advertisers or just, you know, the capacity of these places that are running on smaller budgets than a place like the New York Times to do that work. But, you know, a good journalist is devoted to getting a good story for sure. But at the same time, you know, there are definitely concerns of art journals and magazines shrinking right now. There's the question of criticism, which I'm always interested in, of like, you know, why do we like only get positive reviews anymore? The amount of negative reviews are really de minimis at this point. And maybe that's changing though. It feels like there's energy in the wind in New York and abroad right now, where there's, you know, there's a desire for something new and a different, more sustainable format of arts journalism. So I'm hopeful.
I hear you. I mean, I've seen several independent arts criticism journals sort of emerging in a more kind of public way over the last few years that has made me feel hopeful about that as well.
But they're not getting paid anything is the problem.
This is, I mean, how, yeah, and that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about is the system for, or the structure for arts criticism to actually be funded at an in an independent way, does not lend itself to critical coverage. And, I mean,
Well, yeah, let me talk about that a little bit. The dirty secret in the art world is that reviews get very little readership, with the exception of, I think, some of the really major New York Times reviews that we have, which, I can't speak to specific numbers, but you would be shocked at how popular, some of the reviews that we publish are. But I think on the average level, having worked at a lot of art trade publications, virtually every single one of them, it's a labor of love to be publishing and commissioning art reviews. But at the same time, I think it's easy to get stuck in this echo chamber of like, oh, the reviews are not going to get a lot of readers, so let's not, invest in the resources or really thinking about what it means to do a review, right? The design of a review, what goes into it. Like, should we just be reviewing one show, or should we be trying to establish some sort of bigger message or opinion, in a review?
Do you see that structure growing in such a way that that can happen more?
I think that there are better questions being asked of reviews right now from people in the industry. I think then on the other side of things, you also have somewhere like the Manhattan Review of Art, which is, sounds really prestigious, but it's like run by one guy who has another job. But he sees so much art, and he posts a lot of negative reviews. And I still think it's sort of like a cult sort of read. Like, it's not like this widely popular thing, but it's gotten a lot of attention because, it's lightly edited, it's very opinionated, but it also is like very steeped in what's happening in the contemporary art world right now, and is unafraid to say, I saw this show at a blue chip gallery and it was bullshit,
That happens.
that happens quite a bit sometimes. We're coming out of a, I think, just a lack of those voices who, and sometimes there's the question of like, well, if it's that bad, like, why bother covering it, right? Like, why do we want to write about bad art?
Done well, it can be the most fun thing to read. I'll say that. I've had the pleasure of getting to know Momus magazine up in Canada a bit, and they have a mentorship program for young arts journalists and young critics. And I think that's such an interesting model to think about what mentorship can look like in this field, and just feels like it's something that's so necessary.
And I think, like, the boogeyman in the room that we're not mentioning, though, is that many of these blue chip art galleries, including Gagosian or Hauser and Wirth, have their own sort of editorial operations.
Yes.
And, I mean, you can find Gagosian magazine in like every ritzy hotel. Like, the circulation is quite impressive, but of course, they're not pretending that it's independent journalism. I think they had a quote in that New Yorker story about Larry Gagosian that, it was about extending sort of the Gagosian brand of looking at contemporary art. So I think there's also a wide misunderstanding in the general public of like what arts journalism is and should be.
I hear you. Is there something that you just feel is criminally underreported at the moment? Is there something that you think really would be deserving of a really bright spotlight that's just not getting it?
Usually when I feel that way, then I start reporting on it.
Yeah.
So maybe it's a good question for you. I mean, is there an area that you feel is criminally underreported?
I mean, well, I think a lot of the issues that we've talked about are things that are deserving of a lot more coverage. I do think that I think there needs to be much more frank discussion around not so much art and the art world or the art ecosystem, but the artists themselves that are acting in this world. I feel like there's so much happening among emerging artists in the way that they understand what it means to be a quote-unquote professional artist, their relationship to these insane markets that, as you said, have no regulation. And they're the ones who are actively, participating and essentially, producing content, if you will, for this market. And I think there's a very active world of confusion and opportunity and immense pressures that are affecting emerging artists that I believe if it were discussed a little more openly would actually illuminate and help the public understand a key component of this larger realm that we're all participating in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it definitely makes sense. And it's actually a really big component of my upcoming book.
Yes.
We'll get into in a little bit, maybe,
I'd love to.
about artists who got their big break during NFTs and maybe were not in the traditional art market. And suddenly, there was all this interest preying upon them. So I hear you. The barrier, I would say, in all honesty, of doing that reporting is that the art world, and more than any other sort of industry I've reported on, has a very strong PR arm. And so getting access to these artists and having them speak to you honestly and not off of,
That is true.
really canned responses that like just are not publishable, like just being like, I don't think about the market. I just think about my art. It's just like, I don't know if you're human and you're not like a trust fund baby, then I think you are thinking about
Of
the market.
course.
How could you
Of
not think about
course.
your how you make a living? So there are challenges to doing that work, but I think, if you look at the profile we did on Jade Kukuri Olivo, also known as Puppies Puppies, who currently has a show at the New Museum. Which is also a lot about technology and surveillance, as we've been talking about. That was one of those moments where I could do that story on someone who's still kind of an emerging artist, maybe on the way to mid-career, I'm not sure. But we had a talk in her apartment, and it there wasn't someone sitting right next to her, tapping her on the shoulder, trying to feed her lines. She was just herself. And I understand the fear, right? There's this fear of like, the reporter is going to take things out of context or you're going to say something stupid on the record. But I think ultimately, like, I don't know if you want to do this, like you have to have a little bit of trust, like research the reporters you're talking to and you can have conversations with them before just to like ask about the process. Like, especially when I do investigations, I always put that in my email. Like, if you have any question about the process of reporting, like, we can talk about that first. Sorry,
I hear
you're.
you. So many of the stories that you report on are very complex. They have really long arcs of, resolution or activity. And how do you manage that in terms of deciding which stories to follow over a longer period of time or check back in on, or how do you sort of deal with like getting to a point of resolution even in some of these larger stories that you work on?
I think it might vary on from journalist to journalist. For me, like I am someone who runs fast. Like I wanna get to the story, talk to all the people, and like do it as quickly as I possibly can. And my editor is the train conductor who's like,
Right.
we gotta pause your roll, let's let things bake a little bit. And I think over my career, I've really learned the wisdom of waiting. It is the New York Times. We don't necessarily want to report on something just as it's happening, like things develop, the truth comes out over time, and there's wisdom in waiting often, which I remind myself of.
No, there, I hear you.
When something big is happening. But certainly, you know, especially with auction reporting. So we had a story about jewelry being sold at Christie's that had a very strong relationship with a Nazi fortune that was built. So it came from a family that sort of developed their $1 billion plus fortune from Nazi rules and the disenfranchisement of Jews. So that was a story that, again, like, required being really careful, really deliberate, talking to so many historians and scrutinizing the historian's work. You know, who right. paid you to study Heidi Horton? You know, where did that money come from? How much did they pay you to do that quote unquote independent review? And then talking to outside scholars as well, and trying to figure out even the provenance of these jewels. That's just not, those aren't things that you can do immediately.
Yeah.
And as you report, you figure out really what the core of the story is. So, I rely definitely on editors to tell me when to slow down, because I could just dive down that rabbit hole for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I hear you. And it makes tons of sense. Moving into your book, what is it called? What is it about? And when can people expect it?
So the book is called Token Supremacy, The Art of Finance, The Finance of Art, and the Great Crypto Crash of 2022. It's coming out in May, and it's being published by Knopf. And it was one of the wildest experiences of reporting that I've had in my life. I only realized this later, as I was writing or finishing up the book. Because usually when you're writing about anything, whether it's art or business or technology, you're recreating scenes that happened in a boardroom or a studio, whatever. And in this case, most of the big drama that was happening in the crypto and NFT worlds was happening at parties that I was at.
That's interesting.
That was really special. And the book is broadly about seeing what happened with the crypto crash through the eyes of the major artists who suddenly became multimillionaires, became popular, and in some aspects, sort of assimilated into the bigger art market in the art world.
Right.
I don't think people would be surprised that Beeple is in there, for instance. But we had many long conversations. I went down to his studio for 2 days and really tried to get into the heart of what was happening. Because many of these artists, you know, art was sort of like their weekend passion, the thing they were doing at night before or after the children were put to bed. And suddenly, you know, they're going from being businessmen to being artists. And the way that their art was sometimes instrumentalized in crypto, and the reasons for why artists grew so close to venture capitalists and, you know, technology businesses is really at the heart of this book. And I think for me, not to totally give my book away, but for me, it really spoke to sort of this larger cultural change that I think we've had since the 2008 financial crisis.
Hmm.
You know, most of the people involved in NFTs and crypto are white men in their late 20s and early 30s who were probably in high school or college during the financial crisis.
Right.
Which I don't think as a society we ever kind of took stock of what that instability really meant for kids growing up then. You know, that I grew up during that time and it was very crazy and unstable, and, you know, friends lost houses, and, you know, my family certainly had its own issues. And so I think, you know, there are these long narrative arcs that you can get to in a book that might be more challenging in, you know, in a newspaper, for example, where you can say, you know, what we're seeing right now with crypto and with art is connected. And then you can also say, well, you know, the art market since at least the 70s has been an economic laboratory for the wealthy. There's a lot of things you can do in the art market that would be illegal in the major financial markets in yeah. terms of how you're trading things and making sort of side deals, especially, you know, with the auctioneers themselves. So it was just a great way to get into like three or four really complicated topics like those two, and just sink my teeth in.
Well, let me ask you, what you've seen in everything that you just described over these last few years in particular, do you have a sense of how that will continue to evolve? Are these artists, are their trajectories continuing in the same way that they have been? Is the art world shifting because of everything that you just described? Where do you see this going?
Yeah, and I think that the impulse, the selfish impulse of a lot of people is to say, oh, NFTs are done. It was a blip. We're over it, right? On to artificial intelligence. And there's some truth to that. And certainly a good amount of NFT artists are now working in artificial intelligence. You know, it's on to the next boom and bust for them. But there have been some real substantial changes in the art world and in culture in general because of what happened with NFTs. First, there's been a much larger embrace by museums and other institutions in technology and digital art.
You know,
digital
true.
Art has existed for decades and has basically gotten no love from most of the major museums and from collectors. And now NFTs are an easy way of sort of marketing and selling it, you know, for all their problems. That fundamental idea still works.
Mm-hmm.
It's also brought people from Silicon Valley into the art world, which has been a mission of places like Pace Gallery and now museums like the Guggenheim, I think are really working on that, you know, getting donor bases from people that just, you know, couldn't care less about the art world, you know, a decade or two ago. On a cultural level, it's something that I get into my book quite a bit. Check out chapter two when you buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this concept that I'm calling the optimization of art. There are these ideas in coding and in computer language of optimization, right? Creating maximum efficiency in whatever code you write. And I think that that's really true of the experience of visual culture today, but also the way that artists make work, is this like scale of efficiency, this idea, right? Probably, I think, an unscientific idea that people's attention spans are shrinking. And so we don't actually want to look at art the same way that we might have, you know, a generation ago. And I think that, you know, has both very dangerous implications, but also reflects this like wider culture of video games and digital technology on our brains.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. Yeah, that idea of optimization of art feels very accurate to me, and certainly, you know, resonates in what I see artists doing and in the way that they're thinking about their work in many ways. It also terrifies me. and I'm not sure, I have to think a lot about exactly why. I mean, I can, you know, I have some ideas, but yeah, I don't know. That's not a question.
Why does it terrify you?
I guess that's what I'm asking myself. I think there's just, you know, I think that there is, again, just alluding to sort of what we talked about a little while ago. I mean, I just think there's been this enormous pressure on quote-unquote professionalization of the artist's business. And, you know, a lot of organizations have really focused on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes that emphasis actually is at the expense of thinking about what a sustainable creative life can be, which to me feels like a more broad and perhaps you know, unattainable to some degree, but, you know, at least it feels like an aspiration that speaks to kind of a broader way of envisioning the artist's role in the world. And then when I, you know, when I think about artists who are focusing on optimization or things like this, I understand where that impulse is coming from. I do have concern about it leading to a sense of being that is really built around this kind of boom or bust sort of, you know, mentality or reality.
But I think
and
that's like,
that concerns me. Yeah.
Sorry. And I mean, I agree with you. The Financial Times, like about a year ago, had this article and it was called Generation Moonshot. And it's something that I go into in the book as well, where like, you're right, there is a boom and bust mentality. And I think we all kind of have it now. It's again, that like financial crisis creeping up on us, the uncertainty, the feeling like the floor could always drop out. And I think for a lot of people in their 20s and 30s, having lived through the financial crisis and just this general feeling of anxiety we all have now, there's a lack of sense that you can be economically mobile today. There's no way to increase you know, your circumstances by doing a 9-to-5 job. So what a lot of these people in crypto and NFTs thought was like, hey, like, I know this is a risk. I know that there's a lot of crime happening here and I could lose everything, but I would rather take that risk and maybe possibly like 1 out of a million chance, you know, become wealthy, because I just have no other option. The sort of normative ways that someone might have, you know, worked a corporate job just don't work anymore to really live comfortably.
Yeah.
Especially in a place like New York.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, you know, yeah, I totally hear you. And yeah, I think, you know, as you were saying that too, I realized part of my concern is by everyone sort of being absorbed into this kind of model of a mentality, does that foreclose on an ability to imagine something else, you know? And if artists are the ones, you know, we sort of rely on to imagine these better futures, if all of their time is spent, you know, kind of acquiescing to that boom or bust mentality, then are we actually losing something culturally by not having that imagination?
Yeah, I mean, I want to say no. Because it, you know, art survives, right? Culture just keeps on trucking.
That's true.
But at the same time, I think that there is something very serious in how it changes, right? I never, and maybe this is like the reporter in me and less of the critic in me, like I never want to say like, this new way artists are thinking is bad. But
yeah,
you know, the way that you value art in an optimized system is not necessarily by its formal qualities or conceptual qualities, but in the amount of time it consumes. In the same way that when people play video games, they say, oh, well, this is a 40-hour game, so it's good, right? If it's a 10-hour game, it's not worth your money.
Right.
And I think that has really serious implications of how we're valuing things, but also how companies value the art, quote unquote art that they produce. Like, why are Marvel movies 3 hours long? They don't need to be that long. This is a superhero flick. And I mean, there's some pushback now by audiences, right? Marvel movies are generally understood to be getting worse right now.
Yeah.
Even if they're still making oodles of money. But you know, there's this feeling that it has to just eat up your time to be worth something. And I think that is really, that part is dangerous for artists when they consider making work. And, you know, I mean, it is kind of a complaint in video art, right? There's some video works that, or exhibitions of video art that you could never see everything in one go.
Yeah. I hear you. Yeah. I feel like we could continue this conversation for a very long time, because I'm fascinated by everything you're talking about, and I actually cannot wait to read your book. So I'll be looking forward to
that. I'll
send
you a galley.
Please, that would be great. Yeah.
Don't share all the spicy details that.
Oh, I wouldn't do that. No, I mean, and I'll probably just edit this part out of the podcast anyway, but I was just gonna, I mean, but everything you're talking about is just so pertinent to so many people that I work with. I mean, in all earnestness, I'm actually really looking forward to digging into that, because it just sounds really fantastic. And at any rate, people know where to find you. They can go to the New York Times. Are there other places that you would like to send people to learn more about your work?
You know, if you Google my name, you'll find my Twitter and there. My email is there. I love drama. So, you know, just send me an email. I respond very quickly. And yeah, I guess like that is my biggest thing, is like, I do respond to people.
Yeah.
Sooner or later. And, you know, the best way that I can do my job is when people are really speaking to me about what's on their minds.
Well, thank you so much. And Zachary, it's just a pleasure to connect today and ask you some questions. And I really appreciate your time and everything that you're working on. And I just hope you keep doing more and more. It's great to see.
Yeah, thanks so much. This was fun.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. Zachary is a force of good in this world that many of us operate in, and so it was an absolute pleasure to be able to speak with them and learn more about their research and their work. And if you have a tip for Zachary, I hope you'll reach out to them. At any rate, we'll have a new episode soon, and thanks for listening, and see you next time.